You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
Yes, which way, what, when, how? Mr. Otto D, flip the track right now.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in on this Halloween night. It's hard to believe there are only 2 months left in 2016. I mean, wow, 2016. Anybody remember the 1900s? I suppose it won't be long before my guests on this show will be people born in this century. That sure sounds strange, but at least for tonight, we don't have to worry about it because I have yet another guest who was born in the 1900s. His name is Blaine Long, and if you don't know that name, then you must not have a television because Blaine was a contestant on this season's The Voice on NBC, which allowed him to introduce himself and his music to millions of fans all over the world. And I can't wait to chat with him about that experience. But wait is exactly what I have to do because, as you may know from watching The Voice, Blaine is a dad. And we all know what good dads are doing tonight. That's right, they're taking their kids out trick-or-treating. However, his are young ones, and they got an early start, so I expect him to walk into the studio any minute. But in the meantime, as my regular listeners know, I've been featuring a couple tunes from a new album each week as the holiday shopping days continue to approach. And this week, there's a bunch of music out there. A few records. Avenged Sevenfold's The Stage is a new album. Kenny Chesney's Cosmic Hallelujah. Neil Diamond's Acoustic Christmas. Lady Gaga's Joanne. And Michael Bublé's Nobody But Me. All new cuts. But after sampling all of these, I thought I'd play a couple songs off of Michael Bublé's new album, Nobody But Me. Now, this particular record has far too much modern pop music on it for my taste in a Bublé record. I prefer Michael doing the old standards in that classic style he's so good at. But there is one pop cut from the record that I like, which happens to be a duet with Meghan Trainor called Someday. So check this out.
I love seeing you happy. I miss seeing that smile. It's been such a long time. And although I don't have you, I know now that I need to somehow make you mine. And I won't lie, it's hard seeing you with him.
Oh,
And that was Someday from Michael Bublé's new record called Nobody But Me, featuring Meghan Trainor. And I think that cuts a little bit of a surprise. And as I mentioned, I told you my guest might walk in any minute, and Blaine is here. Blaine, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for squeezing this in on Halloween night. It had to be a busy evening for you already so
right.
far.
It was kids, and kids. Yeah.
Well, tell me about it. So you took them out and about.
Yeah, took them in the neighborhood with the wife. And
just your kids, or did you have to take like 10 of their friends all at one?
No, we had one hanger on, but he was more than welcome, and it was awesome. So
okay, everybody had a good time.
Everybody was good.
Did you got some good candy,
got some
good
sweets.
Treats.
Yeah,
did you grab a couple for the drive up.
No, sir.
Okay, no problem.
That's for later.
Well, again, I'm glad you made it.
Yeah.
Well, listen, you know, it's been fascinating. I think that I became aware of you as a singer-songwriter about a year. I guess it was about a year ago when the project came out and the show at the Orpheum was.
Yeah.
Was that a year ago?
Yeah, I think it
last
was.
Last fall, early in the fall, I think.
Yeah, October, I want to say, but I don't know.
So it was about
a
year ago.
Yeah.
And I knew everybody on that stage except when you came out and sang. I had never heard you sing before.
Yeah.
And so that was a fun time for me. And I was with a good friend of mine, Nagisa, who was with me actually, and she had never heard you sing.
Yeah.
We were both really, really impressed with you. And the next thing that kind of happened for me with you was she was downtown, saw you playing at a street corner someplace.
Oh, yeah.
And sends me a text message. Hey, remember that guy we saw? He's down here. Well, that same day, I was trying to figure out, who do I want to invite to play with me at this one gig I just got?
Ah.
So I was like, oh, that's right. That'd be great. So I called you up, and we got to share a stage
that's
together.
That's good. Yeah, that
so
was
that was
a good
like
night.
In February or something.
Yeah, that was a really good night. I was probably playing at Steve's Greenhouse Grill, so I'm there quite a bit. So I love that venue.
Cool. Well, since then, a lot's happened for you.
Yes.
You've gone on to, that record came out. You've done your own record. You've played a ton of gigs, and then we'll get into this whole story about how you got involved with The Voice and did the whole TV thing and what's going on now. I mean, that's just fascinating. And what's funny to me is that represents a level of success that a lot of artists never even achieve, even though I'm sure for you it feels like a day in the life and now you're doing the next thing.
Yeah.
But it's still something incredible that you'll never, ever forget.
Right. It feels like a big deal. It feels like too much and it feels like not enough.
Yeah,
it's all those things at once.
I understand that.
Yeah.
And I want to get into that. But before we get into that experience, which is really unique compared to a lot of performers, it's a fun thing. I want to get back into kind of knowing you a little bit better, because I only know you as a singer-songwriter.
Right.
I don't know where you came from.
Right.
And in doing just a little quick review, I know that you're from Virginia.
West Virginia. I was just born there.
Okay.
So the show put a big emphasis on that. I was just born there.
They like that.
Literally just born there. Yeah, I think that was a thing.
The truck was going through to
kind of, yeah.
So tell me where do you feel like you were born? Where were you first raised?
You know, San Jose is my I think we came right back here right after I was born, shortly after. My dad worked on the Ohio River and you know, he dragged my mom there and
what was he doing?
Just working on the boat.
Okay.
Just working on the boats. I don't know if he was driving or piloting, I guess they call it, or just doing dishes. I really don't know
what
he was
boats,
doing.
Some of the river boats?
Yeah.
Like the old paddle boats? Like the Bell Swain, I think,
imagine
is one of
they were just
down.
No, I imagine it was just like Freighters. Cargo, but I don't know. I'm just kind of imagining half this. I just know he worked on the river boats and dragged her there and, you know, a young couple with a couple kids already. My dad was born in the same hospital, my middle brother and myself. So it's kind of a weird thing, and we never lived there. So I think it was just easier to hop over the river and that's where the hospital was. But I think Arizona is basically my home. I've been here since I'm 40, and I've been here since, what was it, 83, 84?
Okay.
Something like that. So, you know, my roots are here. My dad was like a ball boy for the Cubs down on Scottsdale Road in the river. Like, his godfather owned the Cubs, you know, batting cages, really. So that was their training ground back in the day. So, yeah.
That's
so I guess
wild.
We have roots here. We have roots.
So are you a Cub fan then?
Yes,
because
kind
that's
of.
A whole interesting
it's,
story.
It's
right
the
now.
Diamondbacks because now I have my boy. My boy, you know, he came home at 3 and a half, and he is all boy. He loves sports, and I don't know a thing about sports.
That's not been your focus, huh?
I was a skater brat, you know, growing up.
Okay.
So I wasn't raised with any sports, just skating. Yeah, so I'm trying. We're Diamondbacks, and then Cubs second because of my brother-in-law and my dad. You know, so
well, you know, baseball has been an interesting thing in America in terms of generational sharing for fathers and sons. It's my dad. We lived in Peoria, Illinois, and Peoria, Illinois is split between Chicago and St. Louis.
Yes,
and so everybody in Peoria is either a Cubs fan or a Cardinals fan. And in our house, I was a Cardinals fan, but I had brothers and sisters who were Cubs fans.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, a little and, civil. Yeah,
yeah. So my dad would take us, me and my best friend. Every year we'd go, and sometimes my brothers would go down to St. Louis once a summer just to catch a game.
Okay.
It was such a big deal. And I remember we went one time and it was a doubleheader.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to stay that long. Now it's a 3 hour
drive. Double headers, two games.
Yeah. Now okay. it's a 3 hour drive.
Oh,
and your kids. So, you know, by the time we get there, we can wait 3 hours to get there because we want to see a game.
Yes.
Now you sit through the game, you had your hot dog and your ice cream, and now there's another game? No, Dad, we want to get back in the truck and go home.
Let's go ride.
As a parent, you know, 6 hours of driving, why not watch two games?
We're here. We're doing this.
Right. So
Did. Did you have to pee in the coffee cup on the way home?
We had to. Oh yeah.
That did you come from that school?
Absolutely, man. Yeah, it's, things were different then.
Yes, they were.
There was no such thing as a rest stop.
Oh no.
There were sides of the
road.
We are
going.
Yeah.
Unless we see someone in need of help. Yeah, we're driving.
That is funny. Yeah. Well, then, how did music come into your life as a youngster? I mean, your dad wasn't musical.
No, not at all.
And how about your brother?
My oldest brother was, well, he started it out. I think he used to jam with like members or friends of the members of Gin Blossoms and all those cats back in the day when they were just starting out.
Right.
When his high school days. But my dad listened to, when he did drink, he would start drinking as the night would go on. My brothers would go to bed and I stayed up. I was a night owl even as a little kid. And he would put on like Willie Nelson, Johnny Cash. Then it was like, you know, the old story songs, the 1814, we took a little trip, all that kind of stuff. And then I think when he was good and gone, it turned to classical. So I got that lesson. That was the only time he liked music, is when he was drinking, I think, you know. And he enjoys it now. He just doesn't want you to know that he enjoys it.
Right.
And my mom loved the Beatles, Rod Stewart, Faces, you know, all that kind of Michael Jackson, Thriller. That was.
So you got a lot of pop influence from that side. And
Huey Lewis. Exactly. Yeah. The big headphones with the curly cord, you know, sitting at the record player, you know. Mm-hmm. So I loved that. I have really vivid memories of that. But my older brother really brought guitars into the house. And
that's what I was wondering, brought guitars into the house. So he was playing guitar first.
Absolutely, yeah. And then bass.
To,
and then
you
my
grabbed
middle brother
one of his
was bass.
Guitars and
oh, yeah. When he wasn't looking, of course, yeah.
Okay. Got yourself in a little bit of trouble.
Yes, I did.
Did you ever get to sit in with him, or did you start your own bands, or how did that?
You know, he joined my band years later. He got out of the Navy, and I was already rolling, and I had the band. And, you know, we were the under 21 band that got kicked out as soon as we were done playing. And
I've been in that.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, that's you know, we got our band name playing the Mason Jar, you know. We under 21, our drummer slipped and broke his foot. And he went to the hospital, and turns out it was a Jones fracture. So, of course, we named our band Jones Fracture, and
there
we were
go.
Stuck with that stupid name for years.
Hey, you got to get a name someplace, you know?
Yeah.
I was in the first time we landed a gig in one of my early bands where I was 16. We were at the fair, the Heart of Illinois Fair.
Okay,
This is back in Illinois.
Okay.
And it was back when airbrushing T-shirts were like the most incredible thing you'd ever seen in your life, you know?
Yeah.
And we had our band name put on these shirts, and our band was called Crystal Image. Right?
Oh, nice.
That's what we
did. Perfect.
Isn't that nice? And so we're all walking around these Crystal Image shirts that we just had made. And this guy who owned a club named Fonzie's downtown.
Awesome.
His band had just canceled him, or he had just fired him. And he saw us. So he comes up to us, hey, you guys, are you in a band? And we're like, yeah. He goes, I want you to play Saturday night at my club. And we're like, okay, great. So then we kept having questions. We'd never played a club.
Magic.
So we're like, chase this guy down at the fair. Well, what time do you want us there? Show up at 6:30. Great. Then we run back. Hey, well, how late are we going to be playing? And we're not old enough. And he's like, we drove him crazy.
Yeah, he's like, just show up and play. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he wanted us, and I hate to keep telling the story, but he wanted us to get outside during breaks, right?
Yeah.
Well, here we are in there, and we had our own flash pots. We had all the stuff we made with flash powder and gunpowder.
Oh, my God.
And our light man is mixing the powder in an ashtray at a table in the bar. He dumps the powder out of the ashtray into our little 2x4 carved out flash box thing.
Oh, my gosh.
And puts a cigarette out of the ashtray that he had the powder in.
Very cool. Very cool.
And it goes, poosh,
yeah.
Burns off his eyebrows, his eyelashes, in this big flash. Club owner throws him out, threatens to not let us play, and we never got to go back there again.
That's a rock and roll story. But that's how it used to be.
Yeah, that simple.
Yeah, I read the Dave Stewart. I'm really big on all the books. And Dave Stewart, you know, just I was walking down the street, and some guy popped his head out a window and said, do you want to come jam? Like, just...
Yeah.
Random things. And I feel like that doesn't happen enough anymore. Maybe it's a time period in everyone's life.
Well, no, I think, yeah, you might say it doesn't happen often enough, but really, most of the things that have happened for you are people you ran into.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, we tend to use people we know or reach out to people we know when we need them.
Yes.
And so you see somebody and say, hey, I need something. Oh, there's somebody. And it fills the gap.
They've got what I need.
Yeah.
Or they can
I guess the lesson there is to be out as much,
absolutely,
out and about as much, and be seen as much.
Yeah.
And while you can't expect to be discovered on a street corner,
no,
you can. Opportunity will come to you because you're in the face of people.
It's your job to be there. That's what I tell everyone. Just if the door opens, you go through. Just make sure you can get back out. And, but you go through every opportunity. That was the whole voice thing. Just
well, and you spend a lot of time performing. You work hard.
Yeah. Well, I'm poor, so I got to keep working.
You still do the street corner stuff?
Absolutely. Okay. That is from a venue, Steve's Greenhouse Grill. They do hire me, but it looks like I'm busking. And I'm on my own out there, you know. So it's like people pass by, but people will cross the street, come buy a CD, and they'll leave. So it's a beautiful gig. I mean, it's right across from the convention center. So it's like touring while you stand still. You know, Walt Richardson taught me that. Look, man, let them come to you, okay?
Touring while you stand still.
So it's all the convention folks. You know, I'll move a lot of CDs, and then I get the word out. And, you know.
And the nice thing is you have a different audience every day.
You got it, exactly. Or you have the same one for 3 days or something like that. You
right,
know,
true.
While they're in town.
And they get used to
you. You become friends, and, you know.
Well, the weather's getting nice, so that's kind of a cool gig now.
Yes, now it's beautiful. There's some nice where you're sweating, but yeah. That's Arizona, I guess.
So when you put your band together, that you were talking about, the Jones Fracture, I think it was called, tell me a little bit about that band. You guys played the Mason Jar, so you were doing, what kind of music were you playing?
We thought we were modern day bluesmen, like kind of like a modern day Rolling Stones. We were not. We were probably a bad, like Pearl Jam meets Live meets something else pretty bad. Like, you know, we're just confused kids trying to figure it out.
A little heavy because it was fun.
Yeah, a lot of distortion pedals, a lot of screaming. Not jiggy, but just, you know, more just the distortion was on, and we, you know, a lot of dynamics. We thought we were really good on stage. Couldn't make a record to save us our lives. You know, it's horrible.
You got
to.
That's where you start, though. You start by being inspired with what you imagine the role is, then you go do it. You don't realize you're bad until you get better and look back and then go, oh, my God.
Until you listen back.
Yeah. You do the same thing to your photos. Like, we really looked like that. You know, that's just the way it is. But it's that passion for what you think it is that places you there in the first place.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So with that first band, were you writing anything, or was it strictly a cover band?
No, we started out original. I think we covered two or three things. We had a member change, and then immediately it was all original. And I started writing all the material, and I had no business writing songs. I mean, I couldn't even play the guitar. I used to work a graveyard shift at the Mobile on Scottsdale and McKellops in the graveyard shift, and I had this real crappy Harmony Hollywood guitar, and as people came up to get their smokes or stuff, you know, after the bars closed, and I was in my little glass cage, but I'd just write songs, and I'd show the band, and they'd play them much better. And then eventually members changed out, then I picked up the guitar, and they let me play guitar. You know, it's like, all right. You're in, I guess. You know,
that's pretty wild. You say you had no business writing songs. Basically, you're saying that you weren't good at it yet because you hadn't done it.
Yeah.
But isn't that, again, how you get good?
Yeah.
So I would say, what, out of the first 40 songs, you liked one or two?
Yeah. Oh, I loved them all. Are you kidding?
Okay.
But I had no idea until
looking
later.
Looking back, did you have two good ones out of 40?
Looking back, there's probably like
something like
five
that.
Good songs.
And now now you've been at it a while, and it kind of shifts the other way around.
Right.
Now that you can tell what you like, you actually finish, when you finish a song, you know it's good, or you'd still be working on it.
Yeah,
so it
I don't
starts
even
to get
past
those songs are better.
Right. I don't even get past like the chorus. In the first line, usually it's kind of like the first line tells me if it's going to be good, and if will there be a chorus to follow? Can I write a bridge to it? I'm horrible at writing bridges, but you can tell right away, kind of like, okay, there's something here that's holding. Now I'm getting pretty jaded or old or boring, so it takes a lot more to hold my interest with a song. I really have to be fascinated with it and want to unravel whatever little thing I discovered.
Is that primarily lyrically or lyrically and musically?
All of it. I love...
So you can discover something musically and you're like...
Yeah, because I'm still a very bad musician. I have no idea what I'm doing. You know, I stumble around and I move the capo.
That's not completely accurate. I would say that you want to be better. But you know what? Nils Lofgren, who is an extremely incredible guitar player, would sit here right in that same chair and tell you, I've got so much to learn on guitar. And I'm
he's a liar.
I'm like, are you nuts?
You know, he's amazing. I've seen him up close, man.
He's not lying, but his perception is that there's still so much to discover.
True.
And that's what keeps you going.
Yeah. And that's our job. Keep the fire alive. Keep it in our belly. Keep the I need more. I need more of this. I'm not good enough. I'm not putting out the material that I want to put out. And I think that's exciting. You know?
Well, and it sounds like in that band, that was a good experience for you, kind of a starting opportunity to write. Do you have any of those recordings? Do you make any recordings of those old songs?
Yeah, we put out two records. And then we did an EP that we never released. But I don't play them out.
And all of that stuff, was that before things were really digital? Or?
Yes. Yeah,
so
it was just kind of coming out.
Not necessarily out there on YouTube or iTunes or anything.
No.
But they will find their way.
Yeah, I think I want to release
them. One of your bandmates thinks you're big enough. We can make some money off his name now.
Yeah, they're wrong. No one's making money off my name. Yeah. No, they.
You'd be surprised.
One day.
Hey, NBC's making money off your name already. That's
yes, they
pretty,
are. Thank you for.
Big.
Yeah.
So don't sweat it. You're already making people.
Come on, NBC. Kick it back a little. Come on.
You know what? It'll happen. It's the evolution of you as a brand.
Yeah.
Has happened to a degree that you're probably not even aware yet.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that.
Okay.
But I've had the opportunity to watch a few people go from being an unemployed local, or I shouldn't say unemployed, let's say employed at a local jeans store singer without sharing a car with everybody else in the family, with the number one hit record in England, complaining because they haven't gotten a nickel from the record company yet for their contract or advance, and they're being told to get their album out, you know?
Yeah.
And they turn into a superstar. And it's like,
that's crazy.
Remember that day that you wondered if you could just sleep at the studio because you couldn't drive there every day? And I said, no.
You need to leave.
I need a place to stay.
You can't sleep under the board.
Yeah. No. So, I mean, it's a neat evolution to watch because the hardest thing for people, for fans to understand or the general public to understand is that once they see you in an environment like that, they assume you're all this and you have $1 million in the bank because just everybody on TV has $1 million in the bank. And the weird thing is, even if it weren't your experience on The Voice, if you had a hit record, your money is not going to come from that for 9 months, trickling back through BMI for royalties. But for the next 9 months, you have to take advantage of every opportunity, including flying all over the country and world on your own dime, to continue to push that ball forward and take advantage of the opportunities that come from that song until it starts to finance the career. So it's tough.
Until it rolls in, And I don't even know, does that even happen anymore? Like, I wonder,
You want to, hey, here's some hope for you, okay?
Please.
Royalties, here's two big pieces of hope.
Okay.
The money in the record business from an artist's point of view has always come from songwriting and publishing, okay?
Yeah.
I don't know one artist, and I've worked with thousands from the top of the business to the bottom of the business, I don't know one that makes a living from royalties from record sales, right?
Right, right.
The biggest names have actually gotten checks, but by that point, that check was 1/100 of their income. They weren't living on their record sales. They were already living off of everything else.
Yeah.
And down at the bottom, and I call the bottom being guys who've had one hit, that's like the bottom of the money.
All right.
Everything below that isn't even the bottom. There's no money. Right. But the guy who has that one hit, he's never going to see a penny from record sales, but he's going to make money from the song.
Right.
If he owns his publishing still.
Okay.
And 20 years from now, 30 years from now, he'd still be making bank if that was a hit song.
Yeah.
For example, here's a song from before when your parents were young, right?
Yeah.
Called I Believe in Miracles.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that track?
Yeah.
Well, the gentleman who wrote that, I was just with him last week working on a record, and he told me that he was on Motown for years, Bobby Taylor. He
Is produced it the You Sex the Thing?
Yeah, the and he thing. Produced okay. the Jackson 5's first four albums. He wrote ABC. He wrote all the stuff for them.
Wow.
He was signed to Motown in 66. He said he's never received a penny from Motown. Okay, he filed suit against them and won an $8.8 million judgment that he's never seen a penny from. But from the one song, I Believe in Miracles, his check from BMI this last quarter was over $100,000.
Oh.
And that's from BMI's, that's from performance royalties. That song was written so long ago.
Yeah.
Now, this is like top secret information. Not really. But the point is, I mean, he said it in front of a lot of people. It's not a big deal. The thing is, when you have a hit song like that, it'll generate money for a long, long time.
Right.
And then somebody covers it, and your publishing income goes right back up again because you still own that piece. So as long as you're writing and the material has an opportunity to get out there in places where those performances are tracked, like TV and radio and film, then you can really make a great living from royalties. So that, take hope in that and keep writing. The exposure of what you're doing is the way that your songs have an opportunity to catch. For example, let's say you're on some TV show performing as a singer and they know you're a songwriter and a music supervisor happens to see you going, wow, it would be a lot cheaper to get one of his songs on my show than to buy the winner's song or some record company guy. And you have this opportunity for all these placements for your material.
Yeah.
Now, that is a real opportunity for you that's coming. And I'm sure your managers are working on that. I'll call
my wife and see if she is.
I'll help you with that.
Thank you.
And there's another thing you want to look into called Royalty Exchange. It's a company that actually I've just been dealing with. They buy your... they have people interested in investing in your royalties, kind of like stock options. They get it. So they look at you and go, oh, your publishing is going to be worth something, so we'll give you this much money right now for half of it. They're buying it from you. But they're doing what the record companies used to do to indies that aren't signed. They're actually giving them advances on their publishing for a piece of it.
Wow.
And then they're exploiting the masters, so the publishing gains worth because they want to make money from it. Fascinating.
That's
little setup.
Okay, that is.
So I'll keep you in touch with that.
Yes.
Because
please.
No, it's real, but it's cool because you've got a lot of cool things coming around. And speaking of that, let's go to some of your music.
Okay.
I want to play a cut. And you've got...
I'm nervous. I wonder what you picked. Yeah.
You know, you put a record out every year.
Yeah, last year was a little EP and then the record with Bright Angel.
Where are you doing these records? You're not recording them in my house.
No, not yet.
You're welcome to.
Come on, Sean.
You're welcome to.
No, Sean's great. I've been working with Sean
last time.
We connected years ago, and I knew it was a good connection, and I still made a couple other records somewhere else, and then it came around. And I kind of believe in that, like, you start something and you charge it something, and you go, okay, we're going to do this. And then 6 months passes, and then maybe almost a year later, you get to working with that person. That's the way it seems to work. Like, I'm really ready to start another record right now, but in truth, it'll probably be 6 months. Or, you know what I mean? Like, my brain, I go, I'm ready right now. And then things, the way the ball rolls, it does take time to get everything. So I did my last one at Three Leaf with Sean Cooney. He's great.
Mm-hmm. He's great.
And he's just really good, and he's got a good ear and a good producer, you know, all those kind of things. And I owe him
a big favor.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, because I shot my movie at his studio, so.
He said, a lot of people have done that.
And I said, you know, I owe you. He goes, oh, I know you do. He goes, I already know what you're going to do. And I said, well, I'm telling you, I owe you. So whatever. It's fine.
I love it.
Whatever you need.
That thing's he's always got people in there. Someone's doing something in there.
It's a great space.
It is.
And he's really good.
And he's made a really good atmosphere in there. And there's, you know. Then I think I did a couple of Orangewood recording studios out in Mason. That was a great studio with Mike Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like the band could have recorded there, you know, like back in the day, you know, Robbie Robertson, all those guys, Levon Helm. There's just a horse sitting outside. There's a bunch of orange trees right there. So that's good. Prairie Sun Studios up in Northern California. Tom Waits made that one famous with Mule Variations and then just wherever.
What's the studio like for you? Is it an intimidating thing or is it like home? I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, it's very much home. I love it. I have a lot of respect for it. But at the same time, I've got to be real casual with it or else I freak out. I have a lot of anxiety, weirdness issues in me. Like if I ever seem really shy to someone, it's because I'm freaking out. Like I'm having a hard time. Like I
remember you mentioning having an anxiety issue, but man, I forgot that. And watching the clips on TV, you'd never know. You look so incredibly powerful and confident on that stage.
I wasn't.
No, you were.
No, but I mean, once the music kicks, I'm good. Yeah. Once I can get past like the first word, for the most part, I'm good. Like I really enjoy being in the song.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy before. I don't enjoy after. I love talking to people. I don't like talking to people when the focus is on me. That feels horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I love people. They're really not interesting because that sounds like I'm a robot, but they, that's what it's about, sharing and talking and stuff like that. So, I have a lot of anxiety issues. So the studio, I'm real comfortable in the studio.
Studio's better for you than the stage?
No, they're both treats, man. I mean, you get on the right stage where you belong. You know, it's a lot of stages people don't belong on certain venues or certain stages or neighborhoods with their music. I really believe that. Like, doesn't mean you should get up and leave. It just means, you know, I've made that mistake too before. Just unplugging in the middle. Like, I've got to go now.
I'm in the wrong place.
This is not right for me. I apologize.
Is in control.
Right. And I just kind of freak out quietly. And I seem very calm, but I'm freaking out inside. So, but in the studio, I can write in the studio. I can,
you know,
I can
that, take it, a nap. Blows, I can get lunch. It blows me away that's real. Because the first time I saw you play at the Orpheum, which was a big venue, I don't know if you'd played a room that big before that or not.
No.
And so that was probably your first green room backstage with all
these
people.
No, but the first real one.
Okay, and this is and we're talking, it's a big theater. It's a nice, ornate place. Big stage, big show, lights, PA. You walk out to start a song, you get started, and you stop.
And I stop.
Because you weren't playing it the way you wanted. But the anxiety to me would have been like you would have unplugged, walked off, and said, I can't do this. Yeah. Instead, it just seemed so natural. You picked it back up and changed. I think it was a tempo thing or something. I can't even remember.
I blinked on all the words, every single word.
But even like when you started again, it was like a different strum pattern.
Probably.
A different tempo. Yeah. You remember the
tune. During rehearsals, I went 3-4 and it's 4-4. Like I remember Al going, hey, Blaine, this is not a waltz, you know, or whatever it is. Yeah. I don't know, 3-4 is a waltz. But I started messing it up. But to handle that live
is the opposite of having anxiety. When that's happening to you and you surf over that, through that like a pro, I mean, I can get that you feel anxious and have that inside, but that's not on the outside at all, which is really cool. Well,
yeah, I think I'm just really not afraid to crash. I know that's part of it. You have to fail, and sometimes it's going to be hard and uncomfortable and not cool, and I won't be able to restart the song and get it right.
Yeah.
I've done that before. Yeah. So we're just like, I don't know what's happening right now, but sorry, everyone. Like, you know, just so I'm not afraid to crash. I'm not afraid to be
a fool. That's critical.
You know, you have to fail. I mean, and I've done plenty of it.
If you're, you know, I think if you're afraid to crash, then when you do crash, that's when you're frozen.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then you just need to call it, you know, like a good comedian. I love comedians and preachers, you know. Another local guy, Andrew Gork, we talk about that, but comedians and preachers, you need to call out the room on what's happening, even if you're the problem.
Yeah.
You know what? This is wrong. This is all wrong, and I'm sorry. Or what's happening in the room? This feels weird. The energy's strange. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know.
That's cool. That's very cool. Well, let's play a cut. So the first song I want to play, it might be one of the most pop-sounding tracks or productions that you've done. It seems a little less singer-songwriter vibe to me, but I really really dug the tune a lot, and it's called Can't Change the Song. Tell me a little bit about that track, which is actually an album title.
The album title. You know, we started the record with Grant Woods and Bright Angel Records, and I wasn't quite ready, but you know, if anyone asks me, yes, I'm ready. You know, that's that. I'm ready to make a reg. Absolutely, let's go.
I got a few stories like that for you from people. I'll tell you,
right? And then you get in there, what you don't have. Oh, we're finishing. Okay.
Oh, that's what you mean. Do I play guitar? I know I said yes, but
yes.
I didn't know you meant chords.
Oh, you meant like really? Oh, right. Yeah, that album was, you know, I was talking to another buddy of mine, Shelby James, another local cat, really good friend, and he kind of put me on my the good path here with a number of things, and you know, I was talking about some problems, and he's like, "Dude, you need to go see a therapist. You gotta go straighten this out. Go to a professional." So I went, and my therapist told me basically, I presented my issue, or my box of issues, and she just, you know, can't change the sun, man. Like, that's what are you gonna do?
Yeah.
What are you gonna do? Like, you know. I was a smartass. I'm going to move to Washington.
I thought you were going to give me like some medicine or
something. Yeah, exactly. Or tell me I'm right, or tell me I'm wrong. Yeah. Tell me what to do here. And I know they don't, but I was really hoping, you know.
Yeah, that's why you went. Yeah,
tell me exactly.
You couldn't get around the corner.
Yeah, am I the jerk here? Someone else the jerk? You know, what's in, you know, so she said that, and I was like, well, okay, you know, all right. Yeah, but that made a lot of sense for the record. And this was the first record that I made that I didn't have colors. I didn't have an album in mind. I didn't have a name. I didn't have a production feel in mind. So it was just, and it was the first one where I just, okay, let's see what comes out. Let's see if we can get a group of songs together. That's why there's 14. Mm-hmm. I kept recording, and I'd wrote two more in the middle of the studio. You know, wrote them, came back the next day, I got two more. Okay, so we cut those, and just trying to make sure that they all fit well. And then at the end, we just said, put them all
out. There's a number of instruments. Is this at Sean's place?
Yeah, Sean's place.
So is Sean producing this track then?
You know what? He is. He wasn't. I don't think he has that title, but he is producing. He's a great producer. So, he produced it.
Because I'm assuming somebody was saying, you know, we need steel here. We need this here. We need that. Yeah. And they were kind of bringing these elements in around you, or was a lot of this in your head?
I brought them in, and I really just kind of trust, you know, the engineer is the producer. On a local level, that's your producer.
A lot of times,
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. So pick your engineer. Yeah. Right, because that's the guy that's going to produce you, man. You know what I mean? What am I going to mix it? I can mix it, but I don't know all the, you know, compression, this, cut, tape, fade, whatever. So he's got an ear for that. This is his home, the studio. So I really trust the engineers, and I lean heavily. You know, so I just, we recorded everything. I don't know if we're going to use pedal steel for the solo, or if we're going to use guitar. Okay, or the organ. Okay, let's record it all and let him mix it and have fun with it. And so that way he's got his name on it. He's got pride into it. And I think that's important.
Cool.
You know.
Well, let's listen to this track called Can't Change the Sun from Blaine Long.
got no money, and I got no pride. I'm a grown man, I won't be denied. Careful courage, yes, cause no pain. Bulletproof, yeah, now make it rain. Oh, coffee stains, yes, them bloodshot eyes. Can't your blessings tell no lies? Oh, picture perfect, yes, your simple grin. Feels so good, let's do it again, yeah. Sing. I got my wings, yes, I got my wolves. I can't change the sun. Yes, I got my wounds, yeah. I can't change the sun. Hey. Well, now, well, no complications. Just a season's change. Graceful angel, human pain. A bathe in the water, yes, drink the wine. And dressed in black, now walk the line. Scar tissue sweet, yes, now gather rain. A sleeping dog, just hide away. Oh, sister pink, you know it, brother blue. I dedicate my life to you. I got my wings and I got my wounds. Can't change the sun. I got my wings and I got my wounds. I can't change the sun. Yeah. Well, it goes down easy when I'm lying next to you. That bullet back in the gun. Well, it caused me worry, yes, it caused me pain. A rusty halo in a picture frame. All spitting up blood, I'm still in the game. I've been prison bars, yes, them broken chains, yeah. And when it looks like it's all over, son, that's when you know just begun. I got my wings, yes, I got my wounds. I can't change the sun. I got my wings, yes, I got my wounds, yeah. I can't change the sun. I got my wings, yes, I got my wounds, yeah. I can't change the sun.
Listening to Otto D coming at you live.
And that was Can't Change the Sun by Blaine Long. How was that, man? That was awesome.
That's very cool. Yeah.
It's fun to hear all of that stuff going on.
Yes, I haven't listened to it in a while, so that's cool.
Yeah. And I know you didn't get too much of a chance to listen to it because I was talking to you the whole time. See, well, you poor little people in Radio Land don't know is we can take our headphones off and go, hey, man, it's good to see you. What are you doing? Got to catch up a little. But it is a great track. And in fact, I think that album's really good. And to me, that album seems a little bit different than the stuff that preceded it.
Yeah, for sure.
Maybe a little bit different of an effort, a little bit different vision.
Yeah. Well, I handed over a lot, you know, and I think a lot has to do with Sean, and it has to do with where I was.
What's going to be different on the next record? Maybe you don't know what will be different, but is there something you want to express? Is there a room you want to work in? Is there a studio that you always thought it'd be fun to go there? Do I want to go to Hawaii and make a record? Or do you have something that you want to bring in that you know will impact you in a way that you're looking for?
There's a couple of projects I want to do. I think the next one is going to be with Sean, because I feel like we started that relationship, and the Bright Angel deal was not a negative. In fact, it was a plus. But I was still immature on that, and I felt scared, and I really wanted to please Grant. And Grant was like, dude, do what you want. Like, just make good music. I don't care.
Right.
You know, so I was stressed out, because that was my first experience with someone paying for it. And I felt a lot of, like, stress. I wanted to make him happy.
Right.
You know, so that, I think I handed over a lot to Sean, but I want to see where that relationship goes with Sean one more time. At least. And then, you know, we have a good time working together, and the session musicians we have, we both really like.
And the communication is critical. And if you have a good working relationship and you guys have the same, when you say something, the other guy gets it.
Yeah.
There's no reason for that to change.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, that can go on.
Well, I think it is healthy to change. Record. I mean,
it can, but if it's not broke.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Right. There's not a need except to be like, oh, this is a new room. I feel different here.
Right. Or you know what? Yeah. I need to try this because we're going to do the same thing we've always done. I want to try this.
True.
And that's the time for it. But I mean, you know, the Beatles had one producer the whole time. It's not like against the rules.
Right. But you wonder about them. Like, I don't know, you know, I don't know
my
Beatles like
everyone
else.
They really would have been good if they just would have changed once a little. Maybe they would have had
some
success.
Rick Rubin, if they could have just got with him, we would have captured their real sound.
Then maybe we'd be talking about them today.
Yeah. I don't know. Poor bastards.
Well, listen, you know, time flies. It really does fly. I have so many other songs I wanted to play. But there's so many more things to talk about. I want to get on this NBC, the voice thing.
Let's talk. We don't need music.
How did you get involved?
You know, that was through Grant, through the Orpheum gig. Someone, Kevin Lang, a friend now, he was involved with, I think he backed it and just helped with promotions and stuff like that. So he videotaped it. And when I started playing, I messed up. Started playing, then he whips out his phone and he starts videotaping it, and he's digging it. He sends it to a buddy of his or a friend of a friend, I'm not really sure. That friend's a producer. They set up a meeting with Grant Woods and the producer and Kevin, and we all got there and they said, how do we further this guy's career? What do we do? And I'm kind of quiet the whole time, and he says, put him on The Voice, put him on America's Got, you know, put him on somewhere there, because or you can spend thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you probably won't get it back.
Right.
So
like in promotion of sorts,
So he said, put him on The Voice. I was, oh, can you do that? Yeah, I think I can do that. So he made a phone call, and I had a private audition, and I really thought I was not going to get accepted. So I did it, and I just, you know, again, I wanted to make Grant happy and everybody happy.
Did you feel you weren't going to be accepted because you thought, oh, that's big time, I'm just starting out? I mean, was it something, a preconceived notion that you weren't ready for that, or you weren't that good?
I don't belong in that.
You believe those things don't happen to regular working stiffs?
Yes. I think that. And I also think what I do is different. Like I feel like I have to be extremely honest with everyone when I meet them. Like, you know, like just whatever, every little dirty detail. Like, I'm sorry, you know, but I did steal some candy once, and, you know, and, you know, stuff like that. You know, I got my guitar just because I think it looks cool, not because it's, you know, whatever. All those little insecurities that float around everyone's brain, I feel like I have to admit right away. And I see other people not doing that.
Right. And so you I'm not going to work. I'm not going to fit. I can't play this game.
Exactly. Exactly.
Interesting.
So, but they said yes. So I said, okay, I got another audition. And that was a 6-day one. And, you know, I thought again on that one. I auditioned. I actually went, and after 5 days I auditioned, and I thought I didn't get it.
So now these auditions that we're talking about, they're not being filmed for the show.
No,
they're
just
privates. And so they're still deciding whether you're even going to be involved.
Right.
Okay.
The first one was 1 day. The next one was like 6 days or 5 days. I forget.
Okay. And then was that the last one? Then they told you, hey, we want you to be on the show.
Yeah. They said, if you hear from us, you'll be on. And if not,
you're not.
You won't hear from us.
Okay.
So it was very.
So how long did it go between you might hear from us and then actually hearing from them? Was that weeks?
It's been about a year since, from January to now is where we are right about now. But it was about a month to 2 months in between. I think about a month usually from you got the call back and said, hey, we want
you're in. Okay. So then you went in.
Yeah.
And shot the show.
Yes.
The season show.
Yeah.
How long ago between when you shot it, when it aired?
June, I think. The whole month of June were the blind auditions.
That's when you were shooting.
So I was gone from my family for a whole month.
And then so you knew when you came back home that you weren't going to be on. I mean, that had been that you were going to lose that one battle.
Yeah, then I came back for
but
the
you
battle.
You couldn't talk and I knew, about it. They make right. you can't say anything or we'll kill you. And,
yes, exactly.
And, you know, we'll erase the video and say you weren't even ever here.
And they do tell you that. They do tell you that. Not the killing, but the will erase that you ever existed.
Yeah, because it's critically important for them. They're completely vested in that. You can't, if you spoil that for them, that's bad.
Yes, that's,
Now, was that hard for you to know you had all your fans pulling for you as it was on TV, and you know you might feel like you're going to let them down because you know you're not going to win that battle, and they don't know it, and you can't tell them?
A little bit. I think, the best, I'll
because I watched
way.
You for that in your posts.
Yeah.
And in your expressions, and I didn't see it. I saw that. Okay, he's not letting on.
He's not letting on.
Well, you weren't letting on that whether you were going to win or lose as it would go on. Right, I liked that. No. I really loved how you handled that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's mostly my wife. So
she helped you.
She kind of took over at a certain point. This is the first time in my career that she said, "Okay, I'm on board. I need to be on board." And I needed her to be, or else we wouldn't have. You know, I wouldn't be talking to you. Like she handles a lot of things, and I'm a mess. Like. I'm thinking about words and colors and
sitting
chords
and stuff.
Sitting
in the corner with
my guitar. Yeah.
Which is
my job. True. And I made that decision years ago to go, you know what? I'm just not a businessman. I'm just going to put my head down and write songs, and one day it's going to pay off. And so hopefully this is the start of that, but I don't really know, you know. But I made a conscious decision. Like, this is, I'm not doing that. I'm doing this.
Well, you know, trust that it will work and trust that it can work.
Yeah.
And then at least you're open to those opportunities. Because it's funny when you think that it can't. Then when somebody comes up to you and says, "Hey, you know, you might want to do this," you go, "Nah," because you've already decided it can't.
Exactly.
As opposed to, do what? And
be
then
open.
And they find out they actually know the guy that
How
they're talking
that work?
About.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
So you have to be prepared. Yeah. And the neat thing is you, on a talent level as a writer and as a singer and as a player, you have everything you need to go through every door.
Yeah.
You know, everything that you aren't in terms of technically yet, you can hire somebody to be when you're in that place where you need that.
True.
Better, bigger band or whatever.
Yeah.
You've always got that. You have an incredible voice, you know, great charisma from stage, and you're a great singer-songwriter. So you got everything you need, and you'll keep working on it. So don't,
assume it's
all going to come to you.
Yeah, yeah.
But so now the thing is on, and again, I mentioned how the Orpheum must have felt like a big stage.
Yes.
This isn't very much longer. You've done local venues here in Phoenix, and all of a sudden you're on that stage in front of those people with television cameras.
Yeah.
That had to freak you out.
Totally. Yeah, there was like 500 people in the studio audience, so that was cool. So I just focused on the audience. I said, you know, I just told, they're not going to turn their chairs. That's cool. So it becomes TV time. Just do a good job. Don't embarrass yourself. You know.
So now, again, you set that bar, so they're not going to turn around.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you didn't have the power to keep them from turning around.
Right,
but
right.
See, do you see
I
how?
Would have.
But do you I see how knowing that knowing that they're not going to might make you not sing quite as hard because you know they're not going to turn on anyway. That's the bad bit about having that frequency.
But that's not
notion.
The thing for me. For me, like I just think, oh, they don't like me.
It released your pressure.
But I like this. I love it so much in the middle that I'm having a
Dude,
blast.
It sounded like
I'm
you
having
were
a blast. Like I love it. I love the people. I love. It's not like oh, they're all praising me. It's just like I'm getting to do this. Like, are you kidding me?
It had to be amazing.
You know? It's always fun. Small stages, big stages. I get to do this. I get to unlatch my cool guitar, smell it when I open the case. Like all that stuff is awesome. Like
now you walked out for your first performance.
Yes.
And you're wondering if they're going to turn the chairs around.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, you know what? If it doesn't go any farther than this, this was a blast. I'm going to do my song, and I can't wait to have that video clip to show people.
Yeah.
And you go out and play. And to me, watching that episode, two things happened. You start singing. And of course, the camera shows all the judges' faces, you know, their backs to you.
Yeah.
And they're all sitting there. They're all trying to be cool, too. They're all performing. But as you're singing, you sound great. And they all know you sound great. But you're not stretching out. So they don't know how good of a singer you are yet.
Right.
And then as soon as the B section comes and your notes raise a little higher, a little bit higher in the next section, then all of a sudden Blake's like, "Hey, this is something."
Yeah.
And he spins around. Everyone starts spinning around. And you had a hold out there. Mr. Maroon 5 is holding out until you went up to the next note. Then he was like, "Okay, boom." Then he spins around. I saw you point it. I'm like, ah.
Yeah, and I don't know why I did that. But
it looked so cool. He pointed back.
Yeah.
I just thought that was really classy. But I had a question for you about that experience. Mm-hmm. Because I thought in hearing your voice that when you sing in your main tone range, comfortable lower range, you've got that graspy, you know, grovelly thing going anyway. But what happens for me, and I saw it in their faces, is as you go up in pitch, it's almost like there's this urgency that comes because it takes more effort. At least that's expressed in your voice. It sounds like, okay, this is a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. And then when you go here, this is a little bit harder. And that adds an awful lot of urgency when there's a bit of a struggle to it. And so as soon as you went a little higher, instead of just being higher notes, you still had all that rasp, but it sounded like, that came in. This is happening now. Yeah, yeah, and that's when they perked up.
Yeah. You know?
And,
I think
that's something else I wanted to mention was that when you did your competition, the battle, where in the end, where they had to pick a winner.
Yes.
And Blake, I really think he was heartbroken, you know, but he had to pick one way or the other.
I do not think he was.
Okay. Well, it seemed that way. He did good.
Come on, Blake.
He did good. But he said something to you.
Yeah.
That I wondered if you've taken to heart, because I thought it was, hey, that's a really good point. He said that he thought maybe you've been holding yourself back by only doing originals, and that you would have developed your voice more if you'd done covers. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because I feel like most of your stuff you keep really in your safe range a lot. Mm-hmm. And that if you did more covers that required you to go outside of your safe range because somebody else wrote it, you might express that more.
Yeah.
And so now there's this big campaign to get you back on the show, right?
Yeah.
Well, trust me, if you come back as the same guy he kicked off the show, you're going to get kicked off the show.
Again, absolutely.
When you come back, you need to have that extra thing that you didn't have.
Right.
And that, I think part of that is going to that top range so much more
confident.
Fearlessly.
Yeah.
And just, you should do nothing but sing up there between now and then. So that when you go back, you can throw a little something in there. They go, holy cow, he didn't do that before. You got to have that
thing.
Thank
God he brought it back down. Jeez.
That's okay. That's okay. But you got to go someplace you haven't gone for them.
Right, right.
And I think that you are going to get back on the show.
So yeah. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know what to think about that. I think other people maybe have had the same good response that have kicked off, but I just don't know, but you've got to try. And,
well, you know, people can't watch with us right now as I play this little YouTube video. They can hear it. Mm. But, of course, it's probably going to have to reload. The thing's been holding up there forever. Mm. It's not probably not going to play. Anyway, I was going to play the one of them. But to watch you on stage when you're singing in that battle even.
Yeah.
Your confidence and charisma is incredible. And I really think that one of Blake's issues was, if I had to bet money on who's going to be received by the country music audience between these two guys, that guy's got a hat.
Yeah.
He looked a little bit more stereotypical, sounded a little more stereotypical, but didn't sound as cool and didn't have didn't broadcast the glow that you seemed to broadcast.
Right, right.
So I feel like if he had any other purpose, it'd have been you. And I feel that if you get back there, that there's a lot of room for you, just not in that niche where he had to kind of decide.
Right. Well, I didn't know I was on the country team. I thought it was the country guys team. I didn't know, like, okay, now you're the country. Now you're one of the country cats.
I don't think it was either until that performance.
Yeah, then they said, oh, you're not country enough, I think. Well, I think Miley said that. I'm not sure if they cut it. Like, well, Josh is more country. I think he needs to stay. And I was like, what? Like, first of all, I'm super happy to go home. Like, and I'm really proud. I'm really proud. Exactly. And I have kids. So it's like, you know, you get tired of being told what to do without an explanation of like, hey, we're going to move over here and then we're going to do this. So it's just move over here.
Right.
And like, well, dude, I'm like, I'm 40, man. Like, come on. Like, give me, I take care of kids. I keep people alive. And now so that's a lot to take from me.
Wow.
It's a reality TV show. So it's very, we can start analyzing it. And I go over in my head of like, yeah, you should have gone out of your box. Like, don't serve the song, serve your voice. And I was trying to serve the song, thinking like it's a show, like build the song.
I don't think you did badly at all. I don't think you could be critical.
No, but I know exactly
what
you're saying, and I totally agree. Like you're dead on. Like I always hold a lot back. I go, I don't need to yell.
Yeah,
I don't need to
be safe, and you don't want to crash.
It's not a safe thing. No one wants to hear me yell or like, you know, Josh and I were joking, like there's Josh and falsetto and then there's me. We used to joke all the time. Like when I get down, I start to yell, man.
But I
get excited.
Bet you can do a falsetto
R&B
thing.
Totally.
You need to throw that in because you didn't.
But I
want to
be
that.
Me. I want to be
that
me
is you.
At the same
it's
time.
You.
You know, so but that's the hard thing is like, well, there's me. And yeah, I'm different at different times.
Well, American Idol, you can't be you because they're making singers out of people that sing.
Yeah.
But at least on this show, you can be a little bit more you because you get to see more of what you do. You bring your own thing to it.
Absolutely.
It's, and
yeah.
I hope you get back on it.
I hope so.
Because
it'll
I think
be
that you can really go yeah. somewhere from
there. It'd be really interesting.
But we need to talk again about the impact this has had that I don't even think you're aware of your brand. And like we were saying when I mentioned we had our headphones off, that you now, unlike before the show, you have fans in every town in America, beyond America. You could get in your car and start in the Northeast Coast and just drive little town, stop in the bars and put a poster up saying NBC's Voice, Blaine Long. And you're going to sell tickets and CDs.
I hope so.
And you couldn't have done that before the show. Your brand has gone from being a local guy to being a national guy. You're not seeing a lot of change in your money. You're not seeing this big change because you haven't met these people that now you're in all of their lives. They're not in yours yet, but you're in all of their lives.
Yeah.
And so you are going to water that garden and that's going to grow.
I'm going to try, man. Yeah.
Well, you're already there. People are finding you on YouTube. They're finding
you on
iTunes.
They've been so nice. Everyone's been so... I'm still getting emails and little Twitter things saying that they support me. They just discovered me or they found me or they just watched the show.
And what's funny is instead of changing two lives here in Phoenix playing in the local club, you're going to change people's lives for years.
Isn't that crazy what music does?
Yeah. And now you're in a place where you actually have an audience that's aware of you and they'll all share it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm proud of you.
That's crazy.
I'm excited
for
you.
Thank you. Yeah.
And again, thanks so much for coming in. We're running
out
of time.
No, thanks for having me.
I'm going to kick off one more of your songs before we go. And before I play that, I just wanted to say that on the Michael Bublé song album, he redid God Only Knows by the Beach Boys.
Really?
It's incredible. I was going to play it. You're going to have to go to iTunes and check it out. It's really, really cool.
I'll check it out.
And on the Kenny Chesney record, there's a duet with Pink.
No way.
Yeah, on his new record, and it's called Setting the World on Fire, and it's pretty cool. It's a little too pop, really. I didn't think she'd go that country pop.
Yeah.
She's pop, but it's pretty country pop.
Okay.
But they do blend well, and I'm a big Pink fan, and I like Kenny. His drummer's a friend, so you gotta like them. But anyway, we're going to skip playing both of those and get back into one of yours on our way out. So tell me a little bit about Healing Time.
Healing Time, that had to do with the therapy again of just like dealing with a lot of issues and just going, all right, you know, my boy had just come home. We adopted him. And so we just kind of were sitting in a good spot with that. So it was like, you know, it's time to put away a lot of these issues and a lot of these things that are holding me up from stopping me from being a better dad. And, you know,
so. Well, let's spin it. This time I'm going to keep our mics up so we can talk about it a little bit. Who's on drums?
Bruce on drums, yeah.
Bruce Tadola.
Yeah, you got him. Big B. Yeah, he's a good guy. John Rickard on steel.
John's coming back to town.
He just made it back. I saw it. I don't think I didn't see that.
Olivier was like, I got work for you.
Nice. That's another studio. I
caught in a moment. Here he is, that guy from NBC. Right through
you. That guy's holding back, man. Come on.
Just a little. I wish I knew you. Sing along, give me a harmony.
Oh, sir.
Give me the high part.
I got weird. My hands got all sweaty immediately.
Well, happy Halloween, Blaze.
Yeah, man, happy Halloween.
And thanks for coming in, man. I really hope everybody jumps on the bandwagon and we get you back on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope so. Thank you.
Right, take care. I found them stones.